From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Texas told Washington, D.C., no thank you for the billions of dollars to expand Medicaid across the state. What's that decision going to cost Texans?
If the state chooses not to expand Medicaid, then there will be costs associated with that.
When it comes to voting, Texans are worst in the nation. Why is that? And the Texas town of West, the recovery is just getting started. We catch up with the town torn apart after the headlines fade.
I've learned the new term donor fatigue. To me, that doesn't really sound appropriate. It's more like donor distraction.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Healthcare advocates and business groups were disappointed at the conclusion of the last legislative session. Their efforts failed to convince Governor Rick Perry and the majority of Texas lawmakers to expand the state's Medicaid population under the Affordable Care Act. Had Medicaid expansion been enacted during the legislative session that wrapped up at the end of May, individuals earning up to roughly $15,000 a year, or for a family of four, up to $31,000 a year, would have been eligible for Medicaid health coverage beginning in 2014. The federal government would have paid the entire cost of Texas expansion for the first 3 years through 2016 and 90% in years thereafter. Texas is not the only state rejecting the health care expansion. 13 other states, mostly southern states, are also telling Washington, D.C. they don't want it. And the states that are choosing not to expand Medicaid will end up paying for that policy choice, according to a new RAND Corporation study. Carter Price is the study's lead author and a mathematician at RAND, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization.
Essentially, leave more than 3 million people without insurance, and it would cost the states, in terms of the federal spending associated with covering those people, it would cost the states about over $8 billion a year in sort of additional federal spending in those states.
So, by not expanding Medicaid, which is part of the Affordable Care Act or the Obamacare, the states would actually spend more money on health care and have fewer people insured than if they had taken the deal from the federal government.
That's correct, because states currently spend money on uncompensated care costs. So when someone goes to the hospital but they don't have health insurance, the state governments and local governments, through a variety of mechanisms, wind up paying for a portion of that. And so when you increase the number of people insured, when those people show up, when they show up to the emergency room or when they show up to get medical care, they have insurance. And so the state then doesn't have to spend money covering for that care in some fashion.
Now, when you say the state, are you meaning, because I know that here in Texas, frequently counties, large metropolitan counties like Harris County, Houston, Bexar County, San Antonio, we see the county governments picking up that cost. So is that a hidden cost if you're just looking at the state numbers?
So that's included. So that's, when I say state, I mean state and local governments. So sort of at the sub-federal level, the state governments, local governments, that they wind up picking up the tab for a lot of this uncompensated care. And so other sort of state governments and local governments wind up eating the cost for those uninsured patients if the federal government weren't to expand, or if the state were not to expand Medicaid.
And so the state is effectively just pushing those costs down to other, governing bodies.
Certainly.
So and so you looked at 14 states that are not going to take the Medicaid expansion, even though there might be more states, but these are the ones that we know for certain will not be taking Medicaid expansion.
So at the time that we were doing the analysis, we picked the 14 states that at that point had said, their state's governors had said, that they were absolutely not going to expand Medicaid. And so we used that as the basis. If it turns out that some of those states do expand Medicaid, then the numbers would be slightly there be more people insured, and the cost, the reduction in federal spending would be slightly lower. On the other hand, if it turns out that more states elect not to expand Medicaid, those numbers would be higher. It sort of depends on exactly the population that which states choose to make those decisions.
If there are fewer people in the pool, if more states opt out, then that curbs the amount of savings that are available.
Correct. So those dollars essentially are tied to people, because that's the federal government is spending money to provide health insurance to people. And so if the state doesn't expand Medicaid, then those people don't have the federal dollars to help pay for their insurance. And so if more states choose not to expand, that's fewer federal dollars flowing into that state to compensate for the care of those people.
So, but to bottom line it, the analysis looks like you're saying that states are acting against their own best economic interest by opting out of the Medicaid expansion.
That's certainly part of it. The other aspect is that beginning in 2017, states will be responsible for paying some of the cost associated with the Medicaid expansion. And so while there aren't budgetary impacts, while there aren't significant budgetary effects on states in the first 3 years, so between 2014 and 2016, eventually the state will be picking up a portion of that cost. And so there may be budgetary fiscal reasons why a state may not want to. But certainly from an economic standpoint, more federal dollars will flow into those states that expand Medicaid, and that will benefit the economies in those states.
And there was a study done in Texas by economist Ray Perryman. He said that for every dollar that the state would spend on Medicaid expansion, that it would get $1.17 back in taxes. And those types of numbers, that's not included in your analysis.
That's correct. We did not include those kinds of effects in our analysis.
And also, we're seeing in California, as they're fully implementing Obamacare and expanding Medicaid, that they're seeing reductions in premiums and in expansions in services. And that's not part of this study as well.
You have to be very careful about how you interpret those premium changes, because it's for some people it is a reduction, and in some cases a significant reduction. Some people may be paying slightly more, and so it's there are premium changes associated with the Affordable Care Act, but our analysis did include those effects, but that's not something that we focused on in our paper.
Now, Texas Governor Rick Perry has compared to expansion of Medicaid in Texas. He has said it's a failed system, and that expanding it in Texas as the system currently exists would be like adding another 1,000 people to the Titanic.
I think it's very important to compare the decision to expand Medicaid to the alternative. And the alternative to not expanding Medicaid is that the bulk of these people, several million people will be uninsured. And so if they are uninsured, they still consume health care. It's just that the doctors, the nurses, and the sort of hospitals don't receive payment for the services that they deliver. Some of that is then passed on to everybody else in the form of higher costs. Others, it's sort of... there may be problems with the Medicaid program in Pennsylvania, but the alternative is to have these people remain uninsured and use health insurance or use health care without insurance. And that has implications on the financial risk for those individuals. It leads to more bankruptcies among the lowest income segment of the population. And so there are negative effects associated with being uninsured. And so that's a decision that that Governor Perry and the Texas legislature will need to make for their citizens and their constituencies, and to really I think they should weigh the facts and weigh the options.
So the facts as you present them, I mean, it certainly does look like Texas is, you know, ignoring the facts and running with the political ideology.
I don't want to ascribe motives to anyone. Hopefully this can help inform the debate in Texas. By not expanding Medicaid, there will be more people uninsured. Texas already has the highest rate of uninsurance in the nation at roughly a quarter of the population. And if the state chooses not to expand Medicaid, then there will be cost associated with that. In particular, the Supreme Court's decision to expand Medicaid, or to make the decision to expand Medicaid optional for states.
So Texas is paying for Medicaid expansion, whether or not we're part of Medicaid expansion, or we're not, because that has been settled. It's not going to change, particularly with the current government that we have now in Texas.
Regardless of whether or not Texas expands Medicaid, they will still be paying for the expansion through the taxes and fees and other aspects of the other sort of revenue generation in the Affordable Care Act. And so the citizens of Texas, the taxpayers of Texas will be paying for Medicaid expansion regardless of whether or not the state takes the dollars to expand Medicaid.
Carter Price is the lead author of a study on the economic impact of states like Texas who are rejecting the expansion of Medicaid. Price is a mathematician at RAND, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. If Texans are unsatisfied with how things are turning out in the legislature in Austin, or if they're fed up with how their congressman is performing in Washington, D.C., they're not showing it. The Lone Star State is dead last when it comes to voter participation. That's what a study found conducted by the Annette Strauss Institute for Civic Life at the University of Texas at Austin. Regina Lawrence is the director of the institute.
We found that in 2010, Texas actually ranked dead last in voter turnout. So that means we were 51st if you count Washington, D.C.
And that's in 2010. So was there anything particular about that election that may not have been exciting for Texans?
That's a good question. We don't have the data in the report to really answer that question, but I can tell you that the data show that Texas has lagged behind the national average in voter turnout in every federal election, presidential and midterm, since 1972.
All right, so because that was a midterm election. And also in general elections, we're looking at general elections, right? We're not looking at primaries.
That's correct.
So in Texas, we're basically a one-party state. Maybe that has something to do with it.
We talk about in the report that there are a number of likely reasons for the low political participation here. And yes, one of those likely reasons is that we have fairly non-competitive elections here. Many of the statewide races have not been competitive. As you know, a Democrat hasn't won in Texas a statewide race since the early 1990s. And what happens there is that voter interest in the campaign and media interest in the campaigns can be depressed. And that's true for folks who might lean Democratic. It's also true for those who might lean Republican. In other words, when it's not a closely contested race, there's just less incentive for anybody to really pay attention or stay involved.
But looking at your figures, it's evident that there are segments of the population that are very involved, very engaged, and they're making their voice heard.
Well, there are certainly demographic groups that are much more likely to be involved and engaged. So, and these are not unique to Texas. These are patterns really across the country, so that you have more highly educated Texans, those with higher incomes, and Caucasian Texans as well, who are all participating more. One thing that makes that so significant here in Texas, though, is that the groups that are participating less, less educated Texans, for example, we have large numbers of those citizens here. So you might know that 20% of Texans lack a high school diploma, and another 26% of Texans have only that. So when we say that less educated folks aren't participating very much, that means something, especially here in Texas.
Are there barriers out there to, you know, encourage a greater voter participation?
Well, a couple that we talk about in the report, again, not necessarily unique to Texas, but true across the country. Voter registration, for example, is not an easy or straightforward process as some people might imagine. For example, a recent study that's being published in a political science journal looked at college-age students and had them fill out voter registration cards from their home states and found that many of them didn't do it correctly the first time around. So voter registration, no matter what else you build up around it, it's not necessarily an easier, straightforward process. In addition, I would say that the indicators are that things like same-day voter registration really might increase voter turnout in the states, 9 or 10 or 12 states that have same-day voter registration. The organization Circle found that turnout among voters was higher in those states, and especially among young people. For some reason, that seemed to boost their willingness to participate.
Now, there seems to be a large voting gap between it's racially divided in Texas.
That's right. There's a drop-off between white Texans and African American, and then a pretty significant drop-off among Hispanic citizens.
So these are big numbers for what I'm looking at on the report. 43.8% of Anglo-Texans reported voting in 2010, 38.7% African Americans, and 23.1% Hispanics.
That's correct.
And that's dragging down the average.
Oh, there's no doubt that it is in a state with an Hispanic population as large as we have. So clearly one of the challenges that we try to talk about a little bit in the report is simply how do you bring folks in who have been pretty chronically disengaged politically and civically? How do you make them feel invited? What are the incentives for greater participation? What are the ways to make people feel more included and that there's more reason for them to get involved?
And there are other states that have figured out how to do that, that's why Texas is 51st and they're much higher on the rankings.
Well, one interesting fact that we cite is a study done by an organization called Latino Decisions, which does professional survey research of the Latino and Hispanic communities around the country. And interestingly, they found that in the 2012 election, compared to other states with significant Hispanic populations, Texas Hispanics were much less likely to say that they had been contacted by a political campaign or candidate during the election. So one part of the equation seems to be how hard do parties and candidates and other organizations try to reach these voters or potential voters and talk to them in a way that again, makes them feel invited in.
Is there a trend? This is just a look at one election, 2010, or have you looked at past elections and were able to figure out a trend?
Well, the voting data, again, the trend is very clear that voting rates have lagged behind the national average in Texas since 1972. And, of course, you see dips around midterm elections. It's true across the board. Those just seem to get less voter interest and a little rise with every presidential election. But overall, the Texas level has been lower for decades.
Regina Lawrence is the director of the Annette Strauss Institute for Civic Life at the University of Texas at Austin. They found that Texas is last in the nation for voter participation. On April 17th, an ammonia nitrate explosion at the West Fertilizer Company tore through the Texas town of West. 15 people were killed. Over 200 homes destroyed, including the town's middle school and high school. That was a major national story at the time. There was a huge surge of support across the nation, but that was 2 months ago. And now the people of West wonder if they've been forgotten as they work on the long-term recovery. Karen Burnson is the director of the West Long-Term Recovery Center.
Well, right now we're to the end of registering for FEMA. The window of opportunity for residents to register for assistance through that avenue is going to be closing down on June 18th. And a lot of our residents still have not been able to register. Either they've been busy working or they've been displaced to the point where it's difficult to come back. But they need to know that all they got to do is call the FEMA 1-800 number or go online.
So you're dealing with people who are, they've, you know, their houses were destroyed, and so they've left West. Maybe they moved in with relatives someplace else in Waco or someplace nearby, and so they're kind of not in the information loop about what they need to be doing.
Exactly. That's been one of the most difficult challenges is for us to communicate to everybody. When we use the media, our newspaper, local newspaper, we have a Facebook page, a website, and we consistently hear from people who say, well, I didn't know. But also moving forward, we're looking at trying to figure out a way to get these displaced residents back as quickly as possible, not just through rebuilding their homes that were destroyed. I keep hearing from residents that if they only had a place to come back to rent, and so we recognize that if we could get those folks back here, they could rebuild faster. They can take care of their business a lot quicker, but it's a big challenge.
So after the explosion, many houses damaged beyond repair, and so the bulldozers have come in, and they have cleared the slabs pretty much in those neighborhoods, right?
We have roughly 200 homes that were completely destroyed, and those numbers are being adjusted as the statistics come in, the firm numbers from the insurance companies and such. But we have roughly 200 homes that were destroyed, and we were able to offer charitable demolition and debris haul-off for 50 to start. And we would like to be able to offer that same service to the rest of the residents who need it. And the plan was to save them that money that they would have had to spend on debris removal and demolition and use those funds to rebuild.
So I imagine that the West, you know, is kind of a small town, not a lot of jobs. Maybe a lot of people worked in Waco or even in Dallas, Fort Worth area, and that, you know, they commuted, but now they lost their homes and maybe they're moving closer to where their jobs are. So it's really hard to, you know, keep the community together because people, it's not an easy decision for them.
Right. That is the case, and because the schools were so heavily destroyed, a lot of parents are looking at not wanting to put their kids in temporary quarters for the next couple of years. But if the parent has to be out of town for their job, it's going to make more sense for them to not bring their kid back to school, and we want to try to avoid that. We want to give them the opportunity and the ability to be here, enroll their kids back in the school that they're familiar with, and keep the town together.
Right. So it sounds like this long-term recovery plan that you guys are working on is really you're trying to save the town.
Basically, yes. The explosion affected half of our town, and we're so contained and we're so close-knit, and logistically we're just very well put together, and it really had a severe impact on us.
And West, with its Czech heritage and German heritage and Irish roots, was really a unique place.
It is very unique. The town is one big family. You are either related to or you know someone that you're related to, and it's just the most amazing place to live. I'm so blessed to live here.
So what more do you need? I mean, are you getting everything you need from Austin and from the state government?
We are getting a lot of support from our, especially our county government, but our state government as well. I gave an update to one of the assistants to the governor with disaster recovery yesterday and reached out, or she called me for an update, and we discovered some areas where perhaps the state can help us further our efforts for recovery. And so I'm hoping that they're able to come to town and sit in some of those meetings and identify areas where they could further give us assistance on that.
Right after the explosion, the satellite trucks showed up. CNN was broadcasting live from there. Anderson Cooper, all the networks were there. Now, you know, we've had like a disaster every week, tornadoes through Oklahoma. We've got a hurricane on the East Coast, buildings collapsing in Philadelphia. It seems like all these new headlines and West disaster is just fading quickly from you know, the radar screen of what needs to get done.
It is. I've learned the new term donor fatigue. I guess that does, to me, that doesn't really sound appropriate. It's more like donor distraction, because there's so many other ways for people to avenues for people to send their donations, And the need here is still very great. Our website has some ways that people can donate specific items, but still the need for monetary donations is really our primary goal at the moment, or our primary need, our monetary donations. One of the other major hurdles we have to overcome is our city infrastructure. The water and sewer systems for a third of our town were so heavily damaged that the bill to repair those seems insurmountable at this point. And we can't bank on federal funding or aid for that. My understanding that is in front of the powers that be to sign. But if it doesn't come in, we still have to figure out a way to recover. And so I keep saying, you know, it's no use in building a house and you can't flush the toilet.
So you said you learned a new term, donor fatigue, because this is new to you. You're not a professional disaster recovery person, are you?
No, I'm a local resident, volunteer.
And how did you become the point person for long-term disaster recovery for West?
That's a good story, but the short version is that some of the community was asking questions, and I happened to be in the right place at the right time to say, okay, I can find out that answer. And one thing led to another, and I actually went to our Mayor Pro Tem and asked him for authorization to use our marquee at City Hall to display the hotline so that we could get the word out to people where to call for help and to, you know, to start figuring out what we were supposed to do. And that one thing led to this. So
so this is a grassroots effort, citizens of West trying to help citizens of West. What about your home? Was it damaged in the explosion?
We suffered very minor damage. We were fortunate. And I think that because of that, I'm able to do what I'm doing. But the idea for long-term recovery in any disaster is to turn over what the state and federal agencies come in to do, because we can't do it right at the beginning, and hand it off to the local residents for long-term.
Right, we got to have the local residents involved, because this is your town and you know what needs to be done.
Right.
And you've got to live there.
We have to live here. We're going to be here long after the last satellite truck pulls out or the last article gets written. But it'll be good. Everybody is hanging in there. A lot of folks are running thin on patients. You know, we're going to have to go through a lot of the system to get to the end where we can say we've recovered. And what that looks like, you know, the experts are telling us anywhere from 2 to 5 years or beyond. But I think that this town has the opportunity to, you know, lean on each other, because we already have those tight bonds. And if we pull together and just keep our heads about us, and we can get the resources to fill the needs, then we can recover in record time. That's my goal.
We just need to remind Texas, don't forget West.
Absolutely.
Karen Burnson is a resident of West, the Texas town hit hard by a fertilizer company explosion. She is also the director of the West Long-Term Recovery Center. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to the show at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also comment on our website, tpr.org. That's where we also have past Texas Matters programs posted online so you can listen to. And you can subscribe to us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.